Hi, I'm J.P. Moses with REITips.com, and this is Real Estate Investing Undressed. Today, I'm proud to bring you another in our series of reality-based interviews with real-world real estate investors. And this is kind of my opportunity to get a man-on-the-street look at the business and the real estate deals being done by real folks out there like you and me in the trenches, and to find out what's working for them, what kind of deals they're doing, what kinds of insights and lessons they might have learned along the way. And it's also your opportunity to be a fly on the wall and eavesdrop in on our conversation. Today, I'm chatting with Patrick Riddle. Patrick's a South Carolina guy who's been in the real estate investing game for about the last 5 years or so. He flips some houses for quick cash infusions in his business, but his favorite model is to buy and resell on a little longer-term basis through lease options to tenant buyers in the Charleston area there. He also has kind of a knack for securing private funding for his deals, and he also happens to have a special place in my heart as a fellow blogger. He runs a really neat little real estate investing blog over at mustknowinvesting.com, so be sure and check him out over there. Now, over the next few minutes, I'm just going to pull the curtain back and shine the spotlight on Patrick. We're going to walk through a couple of his deals, pick them apart together, and I'll be extracting and highlighting for you some of the insights and the lessons that we can pull out along the way. So thanks for listening. Thanks for stopping by. I hope you enjoy it. And even more importantly, I trust you'll find some of Patrick's insights helpful to you in your own real estate endeavors. So without further ado, let's jump on in. Patrick, could you start by just giving me an idea of who you are, maybe describe a little about you and your background as an investor?
Sounds great, JP. I'm Patrick Riddle, and I live in Charleston, South Carolina. I got interested in real estate a little over 5 years ago, and I was actually on break from college and heard real estate was lucrative, and me and a couple of my friends wound up going to the bookstore, buying a couple books, and my eyes were wide open. We grabbed the books, I just tore into them, and I just felt that I had found exactly what I was looking for. It just all made sense to me. So we went ahead and jumped right in. We went to a one-day seminar, found someone there that we wanted to learn from and be mentored by. Ended up at a five-day boot camp, and the rest is history. We decided not to go back to school the next semester. Had already bought our first investment property while in school and had done well enough on it to feel good about moving forward. Since then, I've been investing full-time, me and my business partner, mostly in single-family houses. We've done a number of multifamily deals as well, but it's definitely not our focus. Our focus is really the cookie-cutter, three-bedroom, two-bath, ranch-style house. And in our market, our true niche is houses in the 150-200 range. And since starting, we've done over 100 deals. Our primary strategy has been buy and hold, and hold through lease options.
Okay, really, so you don't do a lot of quick flips, right?
Not a lot, but we do enough to bring in cash for the company just to keep things going, because it is a very cash-intensive business, and when you're buying a few houses a month, it's good to have some cashing out. We like to push for some of our lease options to cash out here and there. You know, we might have a flip going on pretty much all the time. And we'll even do a little wholesale.
Okay, now a quick confession. You said earlier that kind of started by reading books in Barnes & Noble, which, by the way, I agree is a great place to start. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't need to go out and spend a whole bunch of money when you're just trying to see if real estate investing is even right for you. I think people should start even in the library for free. But I did the same thing. But eventually, you kind of went down this education path that I don't know if it finished there, but it culminated at some point in a five-day boot camp. Did you like the boot camp itself? I'm not going to ask you who it was with, but did you feel like you got your money's worth out of it?
Well, I was pretty green. Didn't know a whole lot about what I was doing. I had already bought my first investment property, so I really felt like I just got pounded with a ton of great content, but it really took a lot going from there to soak all of it in.
Yeah.
It definitely gave me the motivation and drive to want to get out and want to soak up as much as I could and get out and practice it.
Okay.
But really, the way the internet is changing things as well, there's so much good, solid, free content online that I think the traditional selling courses, seminars, business for real estate investing information is kind of going out.
Yeah, it's definitely morphing. You know, I've been to a number of those multi-day boot camp events, and some of them are very, very good. Some of them are not very good. They're just, you know, they just pound you with other stuff to buy only, and that's really their primary gig. I've actually put some of those on, too. I don't think I've told you this, but I started our local RIA group and ran it here for 6 years, and we would put on big seminars as well. And so I'm kind of nitpicky about those things in terms of quality. That's the only reason I ask. You're right, though. The more the internet evolves, a lot of that education can take place virtually. It can take place on webinars and things like that. So anyway, sorry to interrupt you. I just wanted to ask, what's your market like right now? You said that you're focusing primarily on the 150 to 200 range. Is that kind of the median price range, or is that above or below it somewhere?
Well, there's a couple areas. Downtown Charleston and one other area, Mount Pleasant, are a good bit pricier. But most of the surrounding areas of Charleston, we like to stay in the populated areas. We don't like to go out in the rural areas. But that's a good price point for a lot of the houses around Charleston.
So you're either renting them out, or you're lease purchasing them out to what type of person? What is it? Blue collar, white collar, somewhere in the middle?
A lot of them are first time home buyers. I would say more blue collar. And lease options or lease purchase, that's our main exit strategy when holding property. There's so many benefits to have someone in your property that has the home ownership mindset, that has a stake in it by putting a down payment with us.
Yeah.
And I was just at a property last week, and the tenant flagged me down. We're buying another house on the same street, and he flagged me down because he wanted to show me the repairs that he'd done inside and all the fresh paint he had done. And this is a house that we still own, that he is a tenant buyer in. So they'll even improve your property as well.
Nice. I've had that happen as well. I have not done a lot of lease option selling. I've done a little of it, but I've experienced the exact same thing, and it's always nice when somebody is so proud to show you how they've improved your property.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Let's talk about Morningdale, the first one. And if you don't mind, maybe start by describing how the lead came in. How did you attract it in the first place?
Well, you know, as I mentioned, we picked up a bunch of books, went to a couple little seminars, and one of the strategies that jumped out to us was using bandit signs. And you know, these are the small signs that you see out around most communities, the little "We Buy Houses" signs. And we went ahead and just went big, bought 1,000 signs. We always go with the yellow. We always went with the yellow and black. Just standard "We Buy Houses" phone number, website, that sort of thing. And we had just committed to putting out at least 75 signs a week. That was one of our main marketing strategies. And at the time, when we were getting started, there wasn't many other people using bandit signs, especially not like that. So it was a good strategy for us to get in. That was a low-cost strategy, and that's where this particular lead on Morningdale came from. So she called us, and it was interesting. She was single. She was the sole owner of the house, and her family all lived in Virginia. She had a couple sick family members that she wanted to get out of town to go back to be with them, and this house was the only thing that was holding her back from leaving.
Okay.
And I guess one of the things that she did not want to do was list it the traditional way. I specifically remember her saying that she did not want realtors coming in and out of her property with people that she didn't know showing her house.
Was that the main reason? Was she just didn't feel comfortable with the idea of that, or was there some kind of time constraint on her?
I think that the major motivation was her sick family members that she wanted to get back home to. And so she was looking for a fast solution, a quick cash offer. And I think just she seemed just a little anxious about having to deal with anybody. So whenever she looked into the investor angle, selling, to an investor, I think that appealed to her just because she would only have to deal with one person.
Okay.
And so, you know, we asked all the questions to find out about her financial info with the house. The house was free and clear. And
nice.
Exactly. Anytime you come across a free and clear property, as a creative investor, there's just boundless opportunity and ways to structure a deal. She had paid cash when she bought it. And, the house was in good shape. It's actually in an area called Mount Pleasant, which is a very, very nice area. It was a desirable neighborhood, and the house really, it just needed some cosmetics. So the property didn't need much work. She was highly motivated, wanted a quick solution, and so it was very ripe for us to come in and make a good offer to her.
Now this is a phenomenal situation for you to step into. I just want to let anyone else who might be eavesdropping in on our conversation know that it doesn't have to look like that in order to be a good deal, though, because those are not your normal deals. But that's awesome. So take us through it.
All right. Well, whenever we were determining our offer, you know, we went ahead and did all of our comps, and just with the other properties in the neighborhood that we knew of that were listed and had sold and such, we knew that a good value for the property, a solid value, was 165 to 170. And so we went in and offered her $112,000 cash, closed in 2 weeks. And this was back whenever we were getting started. And at that point in time, we didn't even have any means to finance or purchase the property. but we knew that if we got a contract at that kind of price, we knew that we would go out and ask enough people and would get the deal financed, period. Bottom line, the first lesson that I want to pull out of this is what I call just ready, fire, aim. And what I mean by that is ready. As an investor, you want to prepare your mind to go out and be able to see deals, because you don't see deals with your eyes, you see them with your mind, and you become ready for them by developing your knowledge base to know a good deal when you see one.
That's a great analogy. Absolutely.
Then you've got the fire. You know, fire is take immediate action. And in the deal that we're talking about, the example was us going out and just making a cash offer that we knew was an awesome deal, even though we didn't already have the financing lined up. That was fire. And then aim comes in, and that's where you just eventually take the necessary steps to close the deal, and you just do whatever it takes.
And you know, I think part of that, too, is you didn't have, you know, the aim, I think, is kind of the lining up everything, having everything in good order for the transaction. And the fact that you fired, you took action before you take the time to make sure everything's lined up perfectly, speaks mm-hmm. to the value of taking action over waiting forever until you feel thoroughly satisfied that all your ducks are in a row. You know, I mean, that's, I can look at a lot of the people who are a lot more successful than me, and one of the things I admire the most about so many of those people is how even when they don't have all the details figured out, they know they recognize an opportunity and they jump on it and they push full on forward into it and put as much energy as they can into it. And even if they do it in a less dazzling way than maybe I would have had I put my meticulous perfectionist personality to it, they actually do it about a year before I ever get to it. So,
but bottom line, you just got to go out there and take action, because there's people that'll keep reading books and taking courses and going to seminars and always think in their mind, okay, you know, just I'll go to one more seminar, I'll read one more book before I do X.
Right.
And bottom line, that's not what you want to do.
And I've been there. I don't know if you have, but I was there at one point, so I know what that feels like.
I have too. Another great lesson in this deal is the fortune is in the follow-up. And I'm about to get back to the story of the deal. But this particular key here, whenever I was at that five-day seminar that I told you about that I went to early on, one of the things that did stick was that he mentioned that about 60% of his deals came from following up with sellers after the initial contact and offer. And that always stuck with me. And with this current deal that we're talking about, Morningdale, whenever we were at the property and we made that offer, 112 cash, close in 2 weeks, she rejected the offer. She wasn't ready for it yet. And we held tight, and I put her in my follow-up log, and about 2.5 weeks later, I called her, and right when she picked up, she said, "I'm ready, let's do it."
So you called her, and then she was ready right then.
Exactly. Oh, I called her. I did not wait for her to call me. I always, any time I'm on the phone with a seller and they're not quite where we want them to be or need them to be, I just ask them, you know, "Do you mind if I put you in my follow-up log?" And then a lot of times I'll even ask, you know, "When would you like to receive a call back?" And I let them dictate it, whether it's a week, a month, a year from now. And that's been one of the key ways that we've gotten a lot of the deals that we have.
It's a great tip.
And so the offer got accepted. Now what? Immediately put together an action plan for the financing there. And what that consisted of was writing down everyone that I could think of that would possibly have a remote interest in financing that deal. Anybody that I met at networking meetings, any kind of contact, I was just thinking, you know, who do I know that may be interested in himself or may know somebody who's interested? And that did not get us to where we needed to be. We ended up having to hit the road on foot and decided to go door to door to some of the different real estate offices, just mortgage brokers, real estate agents, that sort of thing, and ended up finding somebody who financed the deal. And this is kind of a key that over the years of recruiting private investors for our company that I've found, the best sources of cash come from two different types of people. One type is people that know and trust you, and another type is people that know a good deal when they see one. And so now looking back on this, this was a guy in this real estate office that knew a good deal when he saw one, because we brought him that contract for $112,000. He knew it was worth $170,000. And so we struck up a partnership agreement where he put up the financing for the deal, for the purchase price, for the small amount of cosmetic work, everything needed, and we gave him 25% of the net profit in the deal. So that's how we set that one up.
So he didn't charge you like a loan fee or anything like that. It was strictly just a cut of the deal. He puts up the cash, he gets a cut.
25% net profit, end of the day after all expenses paid.
Okay.
And since then, most all of the different lenders that I've brought into our company to finance our deals are all on just a rate and term base. But that worked out great. It worked out terrific because he was also very knowledgeable about the real estate market as well, because he was an agent himself and had also been an investor for years. So he knew a good deal when he saw one, was willing to put up the money, and it was just a win-win-win. And I'll hit on lesson number three here for this deal. Bottom line, good deals get financed if you ask until. If you go out and if you're easily, put into a negative state whenever someone rejects any kind of offer that you make, then this is going to be a tough game, because you've got to be able to fight back and just take a no for what it is, which is just next. You know, who's the next person? Because if you believe it, you can go out and do it yourself.
It's hard, you know. I mean, that's a classic sales thing. If anybody who's ever heard, who's ever been in sales, has heard that. But it's hard initially to get past the idea that this is somehow a personal rejection of you. You know, I mean, you feel the word no really on a personal level a lot of times, with few exceptions. And so while it's really important to get past that and to develop, I guess, maybe I want to say a thicker skin, but I think the reality is a more accurate perspective on the situation. I think you got to grab that, but it is hard. I can really relate to the challenge of not wanting to hear somebody reject your offer.
Exactly. And, you know, end of the day, we ended up doing a little bit of cosmetic work, put it back on the market. At that time, the market was pretty hot, and so it sold quickly, and we netted for our portion of the profit, a little over $23,000.
Not a bad payday. Now, so that was a flip. I mean, you just...
It was. And actually, the way that it ended up, it was pretty incredible, because from the day that we bought it to the day that we had our check in hand, it was right under 2 months.
Okay.
Which is, you know, I'm sure from doing deals yourself that's not as commonplace as we would like. Oftentimes it takes a little longer than that.
So let's pretend that were to happen, that this deal were transplanted into today's market. I assume your area is a buyer's market like so much of the rest of the nation right now. Is that right?
It is. And any time that we even consider flipping a property in today's market, we know that we've got to buy it low enough where we can, you know, renovate it and get it into excellent condition, if not better condition than our competition. In our price range that we work, we typically put in the upgrades like tile in the kitchen and baths and a little bit of molding, crown molding and chair rails and wainscoting, that sort of thing, so that when it comes down to with the market that we're in, we're able to, as long as we buy right, we're able to list it at a lower price than some of our competitors, and we've got upgrades, and we found that that's about the only way that we can comfortably flip a property in today's market.
So if we imagine this scenario in today's market, your seller's motivation, which was, I don't want to have to deal with all the realtors bringing people through my house. Time is kind of a concern because I need to get to the sick family members. Those things would still be in place, and they might even be amplified a little bit more because they would be looking at the prospect of having even more people in a buyer's market
trouncing
through their house. From your perspective, in today's market, you pick up this deal, if I'm hearing you right, you probably would have maybe added a little bit more to the rehab to make it shine a little more, because you said it needed just basic cosmetics, but I'm assuming you probably took it up to a good standard, but it was probably about like the rest of the houses in the neighborhood.
A good standard, not an excellent standard, exactly. We would have stepped up the renovation a little bit, and we would have offered less as well, just to be on the conservative side and just to pad it a little bit, so that if we needed to drop our in price, we'd be able to and still make the profit that we wanted.
And probably would have sold it for a little less, too, because of the softer market. So what do you think, given those scenarios, the turnaround time would have been for you right now with the same deal? Just give me a ballpark guess based on what you know of your market right now.
Same deal, as long as we would have bought it right, we would have probably at least looked this double the time, if not more. And in this market, it's all about exit strategy. And if you go into a property and, you know, your whole mission, your goal is to just flip it, and that's what you're going to do, you better be careful. I would recommend lining up an alternate exit strategy as well, because what you don't want to do is you don't want to end up listing the property, you know, not getting the response you want, you know, drop the price, not get the response you want, and keep dropping the price. Ideally, you would want to have a backup exit strategy where you'd be able to secure long-term financing through some sort, so that you could hold the property out and just add it to the portfolio.
And that's a whole other conversation, the whole
that
long-term
is.
Financing in today's market. Okay, so just to sum up before we go to the second one, lesson one was, I heard you say, ready, fire, aim. You know, and emphasizing taking fast, massive action. Another lesson, the fortune is in the follow-up, and you followed up, took the action to do that later, and she was ready to go, whereas she wasn't the first time. Who knows how many deals I've missed simply because I didn't do that.
Exactly.
Another lesson, good deals get financed if you ask.
Until.
Until.
Ask
and,
until. That's it.
And then I guess the last lesson might be, if you're going to flip in today's market, you got to be able to buy lower, renovate a little better, and sell below market so you can turn them faster.
Yeah, you want to be able to have a better product on the market for less.
And I couldn't agree more. Everyone I know who is flipping houses in today's market has said the exact same thing.
Exactly.
Okay, let's talk about Teakwood.
Old Teakwood. This is a property in Charleston, And let's kind of go through it kind of the same way that we did last time. First, let's hit on marketing, exactly how the lead came in. And we've done a number of different direct mail campaigns over the years, and one of which we did that I've had some pretty good success with is generated a list of properties that had been transferred. The deed was transferred for $100 or less. And so I went down to the tax assessor's office and had them generate a list of property owners in the areas that I was interested in and the price ranges where the deed had been transferred. And oftentimes, if a property is inherited, if there's a divorce, things like that, the deed is transferred, so it can tip you off for that kind of lead. And so we did a series of letters to these type of homeowners. And let me throw this in real quick. That list, whenever I went down to the tax assessor's office, for several thousand names in my area, in my niche, it was $50.
Whoa, nice.
Yeah, and that's just going straight to the tax assessor's office. That's not going through any kind of list company. And so we have a standard transfer letter that we send out that just says, hey, we noticed searching county records that your property was transferred. If you're interested in selling, blah, 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 give us a call.
Now, how far back did you go? Was this like within the last month or from the time you were pulling those leads? Was it a month's worth of those $100 or less transfers or a year or a week or what?
I'm not real sure if I understand what you're asking. She pretty much just, I gave her the criteria for the price range and the areas that I was interested in, and any deeds that were in the system that showed a transfer as the most current owner on title.
Okay, so it could have been transfers from 3 years ago.
It could have, yeah.
But it still fit that criteria. Okay, I got you.
Yeah. If on record, if the last transaction for that property showed that the deed was transferred for, $1, $5, $10, $100, then it would show up on the list.
I gotcha. Okay.
So the lead came in, and it was actually the owner to the property was moving into a nursing home. And so the aunt, who had power of attorney for the seller moving into the nursing home, was the one that contacted us. From the letter. And so I was in communication with her for actually a number of weeks before we even got the appointment. And so it was it's just the way that it worked out. She was out of town, and then we were. And anyway, it kind of worked out pretty good because I was able to build a good bit of rapport with her just talking over the first few weeks there before we ever even got into property. And the situation was, the seller's moving into a nursing home, getting a little low on cash, wanted to go ahead and sell to cash in, sell the property quick, get some cash to help with some of those bills. And the house had also been vacant for a little while, and so it had a bunch of just old stuff in it, and the property desperately needed updating, so they knew that it needed a good bit of work, and they didn't want to do it themselves. So this was another situation where there was definitely some motivation there. As far as the financial info, there was very little owed on the property, and so there was a good bit of equity again to work with, which, as we mentioned on the last deal, a lot of times, especially today with all the refinances over the last years, you don't always come into seller leads that have a lot of equity. But I will say that the transfer list, these mailers that I sent out, I've never gotten as many leads with as much equity from any other marketing campaign.
Really?
So, I'm dead serious. I've had more free and clear leads from those transfer letters than any other marketing campaign I've ever done.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that... Well, and maybe you brought up a good point, because some of these properties may have been transferred a while back. I think that people inherit properties, and sometimes they live out of area, out of state, and a lot of times they'll have it with a property management company and just let them handle it and rent it out for a number of years. And I guess, but a lot of times with these type of leads, the people that are passing down these homes have just been paying on them for a while.
So you're dealing, just to recap, with that particular type of a list, you're probably mostly dealing with probate transfers, right, of
a lot of
somebody
times,
who's inherited,
yeah.
Or
mm-hmm.
Divorce transfers.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not REO transfers. I think
no.
Those are...
I think we disqualified those just the way that we because it was only personal owners that I asked for. If it was any kind of business entity or trust, we disqualified those from our list.
Yep, that makes sense. It had to be going to maybe an individual's name.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
What else? Any other kinds of leads that would focus on besides probate and divorce that you can think of?
I guess sometimes I guess people will go in with each other and buy little investment properties and then things not work out and deed it over to the other party. But those are the main ones.
Maybe tax transfers. Well, long story short, it's going to be a really unique list of the kind that apparently a lot more people have equity in place than most of the target lists that you're going to focus on. So,
I would recommend give it a try in your market and see what kind of results you got, because we've got some pretty good ones.
Very good.
And back to the deal here, right whenever we started talking, the woman was asking $175,000 for the house. And whenever we analyzed the deal, the subject property was a good bit smaller than the rest of the houses in the neighborhood. And when I say a good bit, this property we were looking into was about 1,000 square feet. And most of the other houses around were in the 1,400 to 1,800 square foot range.
Yeah, notably
so,
smaller.
Yeah, a lot smaller. So we had to be careful on this one as far as how we came about what we thought it was worth and valued it. And ultimately, we thought we had to be very conservative. And one of the lessons that I wanted to point out here is don't disqualify the lead strictly on asking price. Because I had drawn out the motivation. You know, I had built some rapport with her. We had looked into it. And I started planting seeds with her as I was talking to her before we got the appointment that I thought she was pretty far off on her asking price. Because, yes, there were other homes in the area that had sold for that, but her house was much smaller and in need of a lot of work. So just kind of sort of working on her throughout the process. As far as how the negotiation went down, the way we set it up, I handle for our company a lot of the front-end work with our marketing, with incoming seller leads, with doing the due diligence to find out on the front end, you know, what we think the house is really worth, if it's worth sending my business partner out to negotiate with them, you know, if we think there's a deal there potentially. And we also, our renovation manager at the time, he would go out and sometimes if it worked out, we would send him in prior to my business partner Dusty going in to negotiate. And that's how this kind of worked out. Because she was out of town, so we had a chance to go ahead over to the property and evaluate the repairs that were needed. So we sent Tim over, who gave us a very detailed estimate of repairs, and we even told her, you know, we're going to go ahead and do all this legwork up front. You know, we're going to look into it to see exactly what we can offer you, and we wouldn't know that unless we put all these numbers together. And so by the time she was back in town and I sent Dusty in to go negotiate with her, I had been talking with her for a few weeks. We had sent our renovation manager over there. Now we're sending Dusty to negotiate. And I think we had built a lot of value in our professionalism and team with her, which ended up working out for us. And so Dusty met with her. He went over kind of where we were at. And our offer was actually $81,500.
Really?
Which for someone to start out asking $175,000 and for you to go in and offer them $81,500, that's a heck of a difference.
Now, be honest. Were you just a little bit embarrassed or shy to to set that offer, even though it was the right offer to make? Was there a little part of you that just kind of cringed and said, oh, I don't know if I want to do this?
There still is a little something there. But, you know, I just try to condition my mind to know that, hey, we're the investors out here sticking our necks out to make these kind of offers, to take the risk on, to borrow the funds and to buy the house and to do the renovations and to withstand the market conditions. So,
a dear friend of mine always says you should, if you're not embarrassed to make an offer, you offer too much.
Exactly. Another good one is, if your first offer is ever accepted, you messed up big.
You just offered too much. That's right.
Yeah, you offered too much. Oh, wow. And so initially, again, she actually did not just accept our offer whenever we were in the house. Immediately when Dusty left, one of the things that we always do is, whether we get a contract or not, we always shoot them a thank you note same day. And she called us back the next day as soon as she got the thank you card in the mail and said, let's do it.
Wow. Now, okay, I know we've been talking for a minute here, but that's really a cool tip. And I'll tell you what I sense happening there. You made your offer to her. She had kind of a sticker shock reaction and turned it down, right? Because, whoa, this is so much less. Then she kind of simmered on it, right? She's kind of mulling it over in her mind. She gets past the initial, you know, who do they think they are to offer me such a small price for my house? It begins to think, well, but this could really solve my problem. How much is it worth to me? And the fact is, there's a lot of people who are looking at these situations, and they're not primarily money motivated, or they go through the process of transition to where eventually they're not money motivated. It's the relief from whatever the situation is that's primarily motivating them. I've been in that situation a bunch myself where people accepted offers I didn't think they would, or they came back to me a short time or quite a ways afterwards and said, let's do it, because they turned that corner. So it's really interesting, because the fact that you followed up with that little letter, that little thank you note one day later, brought you right back to the top of her mind. She took action right then.
And she even told us that during the process there was one other investor that she was meeting with and talking to. So we always like to keep tabs on. We always ask specifically when we're talking to a seller if they're talking to other people. We don't want to step on toes, that sort of thing. And end of the day, whenever Dusty went over to get the contract, she even told him that the other investor had offered a little more. And I had just told you last week that the deal that we closed last Wednesday, same thing happened. We offered 58, that's what we bought it for, and another investor had offered her 65. And, you know, we had built, I believe with this one, we had built so much rapport. I had talked to her for weeks, a number of times over the phone. Our renovation manager had spoken with her when he went out to do the estimate. Dusty had met with her twice, and she liked us so much. She liked our professionalism so much that, end of the day, that was worth more to her.
There you go.
Another lesson here, just keep in mind that price, kind of like you said, is not always the determining factor in a deal.
Absolutely.
With this property, we ended up buying it and got it for $81,500. And so we went in, and as far as the renovation goes, like I said, this was a very small house, especially compared to the other houses in the neighborhood. And so we're looking at it. It was a three-bedroom, one-bath. And we're not big fans of one-bath houses because they're much less marketable than even a one-and-a-half or a two. So with any of our properties, we always look at ways. In this scenario, we looked at the house and said, you know, could we add any square footage on the house since it's so small? Could we squeeze in a half bath somewhere? You know, what could we do to help out with the marketability of this house? And what we ended up doing is, one of the bedrooms, we ended up taking a little bit of square footage out of it to make a half bath that was accessible in the hall. And So that was that ended up, I think, being pretty important for that house to get rid of it, because a lot of times on the marketing side, especially if you have a two-bedroom or a house with just one bath, a lot of times as soon as you tell someone the characteristics of the house, they're off the phone looking at the next one, because most people require more than that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it used to be most one-bath houses are all going to be older houses, and they were built in a day and age where that was very normal to have one bath in the house. But our standards have changed so much these days that anybody who lives in a one-bath house is almost always thinking, gee, I wish we had that second bath, or at least a half bath that we could have the guests go into so we don't have to always be cleaning our bath every time we have somebody over. So absolutely, couldn't agree more. I mean, I've done one-bath deals. I definitely have. But it's a hang-up you have to figure out that you're going to contend with on the front end.
And so a little renovation lesson here, if you can add some square footage, extra bedrooms, baths, they can make all the difference when it comes to marketability. And, you know, when I say adding an extra bedroom, I'm talking primarily if you've got a two-bedroom house, you know, can you either convert another room into a third bedroom or add square footage onto the house? If you've got a one bath, you know, can you add a half bath or a full bath to it? And we've just found that greatly helps out when you're putting your house in the market, whether it's for rental, lease option, or for sale.
I couldn't agree more. That's a great lesson.
And end of the day, after we had purchased and renovated this house, we refinanced it so that we could hold on to it because it is in a good area of Charleston. And we felt that it was a good price range and just a solid area to hold on to. And we lease optioned the property, and the tenant is still currently in the property paying us. She is current. And we're working with her to see if we can get her qualified to buy from us.
Wonderful. So the lessons, just to recap what I heard you say on this one, on Teakwood, is, first of all, don't disqualify a lead strictly based on their asking price. Just because they're asking a price doesn't mean it's not a lead. It's something to consider, but you never know when they're willing to turn that corner rather quickly as soon as they realize just how motivated they are.
Well, and JP, if you don't mind if I interject, another great thing to keep in mind as far as that's concerned is that there's two components in every deal that can make the difference. Of course, you've got price, but oftentimes forgotten is terms. Mm-hmm. And if someone's willing to work some favorable terms, you can pay someone's asking price even if it, you know, isn't necessarily where you want it to be if you get the right terms. So if someone's got some equity in the property, there's a lot that can be done as far as deal structuring.
Absolutely. And frankly, because there was equity in both of these, I'm a little surprised that one of the offers accepted didn't involve some kind of owner financing. Not that that's always going to work, but I'm sure it was on your mind at some point.
We always, I mean, that's our primary way to structure deals. I mean, we're always looking at how can we structure it where the owner takes back any kind of note. And it just ended up that based on, with the first one, she just wanted, all she wanted was, make me a cash offer. I want to get out of here. I don't want to ever think about this house or this place again. I want out. And so that's what we gave her. And then on the second one, since she was moving into a nursing home, they were just looking to get as much cash as they could. So, we draw out a seller's wants and needs, and if that's what they really want, we're going to offer it to them. But typically, then we'll offer them a little more if they're willing to take back some terms.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Patrick, thanks, man. I appreciate it. I appreciate you giving me a little insight, an insider's perspective on these two. It's always insightful for me to be able to kind of peel the onion back on somebody else's business and a couple of their deals and see what they're contending with. I know we're all in an interesting market right now, but there's still so many sweet spots in this market. They're just a little different than they were before, but they're there, and it's nice to connect with other investors in other areas.
There's opportunities in every market, period. There's opportunities now, and there was different opportunities several years ago in the market when it was the complete opposite side of the spectrum.
Couldn't agree more. You know, I am passionate about what I do at REITips.com. You know, I consider myself to be kind of an advocate for other people like me out in the marketplace, and I'm glad to be able to provide this kind of content for my subscribers, but you also have a blog, and I'd love to be able to tell people how they can track along and follow along with your real estate adventures. Give us your blog.
It's www.mustknowinvesting.com, and we focus primarily on creative real estate investing techniques and strategies.
I'm a fan, I'm a reader of your blog, and I'd like to recommend anybody that I know, feel free to stop on by. Some good content there that you provide on a regular basis. So,
hey, thank you, JP. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Thanks for the chat.
All right, it was a pleasure.